This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Now corralled there by Kopp. Kopp and a headman pass to the far side for Appleton. Streaking down the lane. Cut in front. Trying to get it for Kopp. What a shot. No, he scores! Andrew Kopp scores in his second straight game. Winnipeg has regained the lead. It's 4-3 for the Jets. How about that?
Andrew Kopp's third period goal last night proves to be the game winner. The Winnipeg Jets defeat the New York Rangers by a 4-3 margin. They get their eighth win in their past nine home games. Things started off well for the Jets last night, obviously. A 2-0 lead after 20 minutes. They thought they didn't have to play for the second period, and they were quickly down 3-2 early in the third, only to see two unlikely goal scorers tie it up and then give the Jets the game-winning goal. Joe Morrow with his first of the year, Andrew Kopp with his sixth of the year, and the Jets pull off the 4-3 home ice victory over the New York Rangers. Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us on this late-night edition of NHL This Week, we say good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL This Week. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Sean Assor, producer Chris Curry doing the great job behind the board. Sean, good evening to you. Nice of you to join me on this wintry Wednesday night.
It feels like our show is becoming like Tales from the Crypt. Remember that old show growing up? We have to stay up so late.
Uh-huh. Which one of us is the skeleton coming out of the coffin?
You're older, so can we go?
It's true. Let's be honest. It's a fair comment on your point.
Didn't the skeleton have like a little sidekick that he like had kicking
around?
Wasn't
it the skeleton dog that he had with him, or am I thinking of something else altogether?
I could be a skeleton dog.
Okay, there you go. You could be my little skeleton dog. I'm not sure if that says more about you or more about me, but whatever it might be, we're both here on this Wednesday evening. Mr. Ginsburg, the man known as Ezra Ginsburg, is under the weather. He will hopefully be joining us on Saturday morning, but we'll see. I don't know. I'll be honest. I'm not sure. He was texting me earlier, and I think he was speaking in tongues. I don't know if he's going to make it or not. Anyways, as he should hopefully be back at some point relatively soon. Let's talk about last night's Jets victory on home ice. They followed up their win on Sunday against the Buffalo Sabres. Getting back on home ice, you look at this three-game homestand that they're embarking on, that they're now one game in, and you'd say these are three games the Jets should win. You have the New York Rangers last night. A bottom team in the NHL, a complete seller, we know that. At the trade deadline, a team that is certainly in the midst of a rebuilding phase, but with a good goaltender in Henrik Lundqvist. And then you have tomorrow night and Saturday, and we'll get to that, against Colorado and the Ottawa Senators, where the Jets will look for revenge on Saturday night. I thought last night's game, the Jets, first 20 minutes, is exactly how you want them to play against a weaker opponent. And then I think the second 20 minutes into the first minute of the third period, they just stopped playing. They thought they were up 2-0. We're a better team. We're against a weakened opponent. We don't need to play. Well, the New York Rangers, one, you have Henrik Lundqvist. So Henrik Lundqvist isn't going to just roll over. Two, you got some players who are still playing. They're playing with pride in New York still. They're not going to be a playoff team. That's clear. They're not a talented team. The Jets are a more talented team. But they have some players who are still bona fide NHLers. They still have a lot of players who are looking to play spoiler. And I think for the middle 20 minutes and the first minute of the third period, and the Jets just stopped playing, and then they decided to pick it up again. They were able to get the tying goal from Joe Morrow. They were able to get the winning goal from Andrew Kopp, and then they were able to hang on as the Rangers, you know, did throw some pucks at the net and did challenge Connor Hellebuyck later in that third period, but he stood tall, and the Jets end up with a 4-3 victory that I don't know how pretty it was, but it was effective nonetheless.
Definitely effective, definitely not pretty, but we saw a lot of things in this game. First, from a Rangers perspective, I think we saw why Mika Zibanejad was the second star of the week last week. I mean, everything the guy touches and throws on net somehow ends up going into the net, even if it's a triple deflection off of two defenders. So the guy has been hot as of late. That continued yesterday. But
he's a good player. He got 25 goals this year. Yeah, I know he's got 25 goals
having a great season.
On a lousy team, but 25 goals is 25 goals. This is a guy who can play on a lot of NHL teams.
I thought the puck followed him around a lot yesterday. I was pretty impressed with him and Matt Zuccarello as well, a guy that a lot of talk around him. I mean, did you notice the end-to-end rush from Kevin Hayes and some of the cheers going on in the crowd? Perhaps maybe, ooh, we could use that on our team.
Big man, speed.
A little bit of hands.
A little bit of hands. He did go through all the players. He didn't able. To, wasn't able to deposit it past Connor Hellebuck. But I think everybody that watched that game and everybody who's a Winnipeg Jets fan noticed that rush by Kevin Hayes is sort of a bit of an audition for him. You know, hey, look what I can do. Maybe just, you know, I won't board the charter wherever the Rangers went after the game. I'll just stay here and I'll come across to your dressing room and get into the heart of a playoff race.
I can stay here, guys. It's all good.
Yeah.
But, you know, focusing on the Jets, I mean, what can you – Mark Scheifele comes out guns blazing. I mean, two absolutely gorgeous goals. But I think a lot of credit on both those goals has to go to the captain, Blake Wheeler. I mean, the first one, from his knees, kind of deflects the puck out of the air, enables Tyler Myers to make that pinch, cuts to the net, backhand, creates the chaos off the save from Henrik Lundqvist. And then we saw just how, you know – the turmoil unfolds, cross-ice pass to Scheifele, waits out the five-hole, absolutely gorgeous goal. The second goal, Wheeler causes the turnover in the neutral zone, bats a puck out of the air, quick up, and then drives the net. That's another thing, you know, turns the puck over, but doesn't kind of lollygag in the neutral zone, drives the net, backs up the defender of the New York Rangers, allowing Scheifele that lane to come in, and then we just saw the absolute pure skill of Mark Scheifele to be able to toe-drag, snapshot that in on Henrik Lundqvist. And then the third goal from Blake Wheeler, another tremendous play, causing turnovers, causing a whole bunch of havoc in the offensive zone, and provides the screen. Scheifele sets up Joe Morrow first of the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Jets didn't play a full 60 minutes. There's no question about that last night.
Josh Morrissey echoed that sentiment in our second period walk-off. You could kind of hear it in his tone going, yeah, we just stopped skating. He said it flat out.
That second period was atrocious for the Jets. If you look at the 5-on-5 Corsi in that second period, it was 74% for the Rangers, the 25.9% for the Jets.
That's not good.
I don't have to be a mathematician to tell you that those aren't good numbers. And, you know, the first period was obviously, you know, to the Jets' advantage. The third period was to the Jets' advantage. I think that the Jets probably just took the Rangers for granted after that first period. We have a 2-0 lead, and, well, what do the Rangers have to play for? We can just stop. We're going to stop skating because they're not going to come at us. There's no reason for them to try and steal this game. But you underestimate an opponent at your own peril, and the Jets almost got caught. If it wasn't for, I mean, Joe Morrow's goal, I'm not going to say it's a fluky goal, but it's not a goal that, I mean, you don't expect Joe Morrow to score in that situation.
First of the season, right?
First of the season. I mean, it's got a, you know, it's got a little bit of seeing eyes.
He does have a good shot.
Yeah.
He has trouble getting it to the net sometimes, but a real nice pass from Scheifele to kind of wait out the pass, open up that one timing lane.
Yeah. And there's some traffic in front and everything else. And so Henrik Lundqvist is distracted by it. But I mean, you don't expect a point shot from Joe Morrow to necessarily be what ties the game for your team. But, you know, so the Jets get away with it. And, you know, I can't help but wonder if this team right now, as we sit here, you know, 10 days, 12 days ahead of the trade deadline, if not, I mean, I want to say bored, but bored isn't the right word. They're just in this waiting period. They're just in this holding pattern.
100%.
Where the team doesn't know what it's going to look like until after the deadline. Is it going to be a Kevin Hayes? Is it going to be a Matt Zuccarello? Is it going to be a Mark Stone or a Matt Duchene, or is it going to be none of these guys at all, and it's going to be a defenseman? So I get the impression that the team is sort of just going through the motions a little bit right now, waiting for the 25th, because they know once the 25th hits, then you got to go almost hard for a month. And then after that month, you're at towards the end of March, and you might have half a dozen games left. You may have already clinched a playoff spot by that point. Maybe it's just a matter of positioning. And that first week of April, you're starting to rest some guys because you're leading up to the start of what you expect to be a lengthy playoff run. So I just get the impression the Jets aren't digging deep right now for that extra gear. Not that they need it right now.
Well, I think just to further that, I think that the experience of last year's playoffs, you know, they know the toll a deep playoff run will take, and perhaps, yeah, lightening the gas a little bit just in preparation to keep their bodies and their minds as sharp as possible. And they're also, you look at some of the opponents, a lot of these, you know, you just look at the standings, it's a cluster in the East and the West for teams looking to get into the playoffs. So they're playing some teams that are playing pretty hungry hockey right now, looking to jockey for position as you enter, like you said, that final and 10 stretch of the regular season.
Yeah, the Jets are in a stretch, though, right now, where you're also playing five consecutive games against non-playoff teams. It started Saturday in Ottawa. Well, Ottawa's clearly a non-playoff team. Sunday in Buffalo. Well, they're right now 4 points out of a playoff spot after Pittsburgh's victory earlier tonight. So you wonder if the Sabres, they're certainly battling, but they're not a playoff team. Well, we know the Rangers aren't going to be in the playoffs. Colorado has been, well, the Colorado Avalanche should thank the Anaheim Ducks. Because if it wasn't for the Anaheim Ducks, the Colorado Avalanche have been the worst team in the NHL since the middle of December, give or take. I mean, they've lost what now? They've lost, I think, seven in a row.
Yeah, seven.
And they've got one win in their last 10. They've got three overtime defeats there. But, I mean, one win in the last 10. The Avalanche went from battling the Jets and the Predators atop of the Central Division to being, you know, 4 points out of a playoff spot and with two teams in between them and the Wild for the last spot. So the Avs have been horrid. You have the Ottawa Senators coming up on Saturday again.
A very intriguing game based on what happened last weekend.
Well, you know, you wonder if the, you know, what happens there. And then the Jets go out on the road, and it's not a difficult road trip. They go Wednesday, they go back to Colorado. So you're going to play six straight games against non-playoff teams. The only playoff game you have in the next little bit, the only playoff opponent you have in the next little bit, is a week from Friday against the Golden Knights. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you have the Arizona Coyotes again. So the Jets are in this stretch where they're playing these opponents that they can beat, you know, by playing only 40 minutes of the game. I don't recommend it. It's not how you're supposed to win games, but the truth of the matter is they're waiting for the opposition to get better again, and that's going to happen almost, you know, they finished this stretch on the 24th with that game on a Sunday night against Arizona. The next night is the trade deadline. Monday the 25th is the trade deadline, and then they're back in action again on the 26th against the Minnesota Wild team that is right now in the playoff spot still. So that's, I think, the sort of holding pattern the Jets are in right now, is that they're waiting for the trade deadline, they're waiting for their opponents to get a little bit more competitive, and it leads to some sloppiness and it leads to some bad habits, like we saw last night against the Rangers, when you only played two out of the three periods, and as a result, the Rangers had a 3-2 lead early on in the third period.
Yeah, and luckily that goal, which Paul Maurice credited that deflection goal, he said that could have crippled our team in that game, and it didn't. You know, the Jets rallied after a pretty bad goal and were able to turn the tide. I mean, you don't like that call on Blake Wheeler, that quote unquote was it a trip? So I don't know, for a team that could have crumbled, it showed a little bit of character. They turned it back on. They scored the two. I mean, what more can we say about this fourth line as we go down this home stretch? I mean, Andrew Kopp solidifying himself as that fourth line center. And, I mean, that's
it's got to be for that. It's got to be hard for that fourth line, because they know that with basically any acquisition, it's likely one of
that line is breaking
Brendan
up.
Lemieux or Mason Appleton, who's going to the press box.
And you know what? That play by Mason Appleton on that fourth goal, that's an NHL play, sticking with it. You know, he fans on the pass, doesn't give up on the play. He reassesses the situation, makes the cross-crease pass to Andrew Kopp. Another game winner for Andrew Kopp. I mean, you feel for them, because absolutely, they've like what Andrew Kopp says, they've earned the right to play, right? They've made it hard for Paul Maurice to not put them on the ice, and now as they enter the most important part of the season, they're
after battling tooth and nail with the team to get to the spot of the playoffs, and be, you know, they're gonna lose out on that opportunity more than likely. It's not a surprise. It's the nature of the beast, but it's an interesting sort of phenomenon that's surrounding this Winnipeg Jets team right now. And we'll know more in about 12 days' time. Monday, the 25th of February, we'll know who the Jets have acquired at the NHL trade deadline. I mean, they could very easily make a move before that. But, you know, like I said, 12 days away, coverage all day on the 25th here on TSN Radio 1290, and a special Monday edition of NHL This Week coming up after that. So we'll know more about who the Jets, what they look like for the playoff stretch run. But for now, they revel in the victory over the New York Rangers by a 4-3 margin last night, and they get set for tomorrow night against those Colorado Avalanche team that is just absolutely struggling right now.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that game up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Across the line. He'll drop it there for Lennestog. Cross-ice pass intercepted. Long lead pass. Now a breakaway. Shifley. Shifley marches in. Shoot. Stop. Rebound. He scores! Mark Shifley kept puck awareness. Grubauer stopped him on the first shot. He knocked in the rebound. And Winnipeg has a three-goal lead once again. It's 6-3 for the Jets. How about that pass by Wheeler?
The most surprising part of that clip was our good friend Paul Edmund saying Grubauer made a save. Because it's not something you've heard a lot from the Colorado Avalanche goaltenders as of late.
No.
Grubauer, Varlamov. I think, Sean, you got a game or two in between the net for the Avs.
Had a pretty good outing.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I only let in 18.
Well, that's okay. I think that's keeping them on average with what they're doing as of late. The Colorado Avalanche, as I mentioned, should pay thanks to the Anaheim Ducks. Because without the Ducks and their pathetic performance, the Avs are the worst team in the NHL since basically the new year. So that clip was from January 8th. That was the Jets. I think it was a 7-4 Jets victory over the Avs.
Yep.
Since that game, the Colorado Avalanche have a record of 2 wins, 9 losses, and 3 overtime defeats. That's good for 7 points in 14 games, which puts them 30th in the NHL. The only team worse is the Anaheim Ducks, who have 6 points in 13 games since then. If you want to go back even further, say New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve, it's a day worth celebrating. Since New Year's Eve, Colorado Avalanche are 3-10-4 for a grand total of 10 points in 17 games. 30th in the NHL. Again, the Anaheim Ducks are 2-11-3 in that same time frame. So without the Ducks, the Colorado Avalanche have been one of the worst teams in the NHL over the last 6 weeks, which has resulted in them falling from a battle with the Jets and the Predators atop of the Central Division, all the way down to out of a wild card spot in the Western Conference, 4 points behind the Minnesota Wild. This Colorado Avalanche team cannot get a save if their lives depended on it. And they're just in an absolute tailspin, and you wonder how, if anything, is going to pull them out of it.
It is ugly. I mean, numbers aside, their performances have been bad. And like, just the style at which they lost, like, we're bringing AJ Happily on later, and I'm excited to ask him about the style of which they're losing. I mean, 3 straight overtime losses for the Avalanche. I mean, at one point you have to think, are we ever going to win a game again?
Yeah.
Because it must be just compounding on these guys. And we talked so much at the beginning of the season, Drew, about how top heavy this team was and just how dominant their top line was. And while they're still performing, I mean, it's crumbled because of how top-heavy it is, and they cannot rebuild this team right now. I mean, Humpty Dumpty ain't being put back together again. This is ugly, ugly stuff. And like you said, they need a save, and they need a save right now.
If you had said at the beginning of the year the Avalanche are going to falter because one of their top three players is going to get injured, and as a result they're going to be too thin, oh yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, fine. Fair.
Or the top line is going to run out of gas and there's not going to be anybody to pick them up. Okay, fine. We can see that. Goaltending was not supposed to be the issue for the Colorado Avalanche. Mm-hmm. Semyon Varlamov, you know, had an okay year last year. It wasn't great. But they went out and they acquired Philip Grubauer from the Washington Capitals. And if you remember last season, yeah. Grubauer was the man. Grubauer had replaced Braden Holtby as their starting goaltender.
Into the playoffs,
and then Holtby got the job back, and we know that the Caps went on to win the Stanley Cup. But they acquired Philip Grubauer because Varlamov was going to be a free agent at season's end, and they signed him to a 3-year contract. And Grubauer was going to get the net, and he was going to be the goaltender of the future, and the Avs had the goaltender. Well, he can't make a save if his life depended on it either. So you have two goaltenders in Colorado, neither of whom can make a save. It's not that the offense is struggling. That's certainly not the case. It's the goaltending. And it just goes to show you that when you can't get a save and you have no faith whatsoever in your goaltenders, that's what leads you to having numbers and a streak like the Avalanche have been having, where they're by far one of the worst teams in the NHL.
Not only that, but they're the worst team in penalty minutes. So they take the most penalty minutes out of the entire league, and then their penalty kill on top of that is ranked 28th. I am no mathematician, but that cannot be a formula for success.
No, when you it's usually not a formula for success. I mean, look at Semyon Varlamov has had the majority of the starts since New Year's. He's currently putting up an .886 save percentage and a 3.35 goals against average. That is in 13 games since December 29th. Now, Grubauer, okay, Varlamov has been terrible. So what's Grubauer been doing? How about an .836 save percentage and a 4.47 goals against average in six games? Those are hard numbers to accomplish, to be that horrible in net. And now the Avalanche have to be sitting there saying, well, what do we do now with our goaltending?
Well, and that's the thing.
This is the guy who was supposed to be our goaltender of the future for the next 3 years. What do we do now? He can't save a beach ball.
It's as if you're going into every game shorthanded when your goalie isn't going to make pretty much any save, and when you have no confidence in that goaltender because you're worried about playing a defensive style of game, and you lose track of the offensive side of the game because you're really just thinking about helping out these netminders that cannot make a stop, and it disrupts the flow of what you're trying to accomplish.
It's impossible. You need saves, and we've seen it here in Winnipeg where the goaltenders. Not recently, but years ago, can't get
in a
you
distant
a save.
Time.
Can't get you a save, and the team. I remember that game against the Avalanche, and then it was a couple days later. Remember that Nathan MacKinnon had that blow up with Jared Bednar, because the Avalanche for a lot of that game they controlled the play against the Jets. Problem was the Jets for the Avalanche. The Jets scored every time they had a shot. Remember it was the game where the Jets jumped out to the early lead. And the Avalanche stormed back, and then I think it was 4-3 at this point, maybe in the third period. And it was a terrible goal that the Jets scored to make it 5-3. And it just absolutely broke the back of the Colorado Avalanche, because you could see the team just sag. You could see the team were battling tooth and nail. We're trying to get back in this game. We're trying to pick up our goaltender, and he can't make one save.
And not only that, I mean, just look at the two times that they've played each other this season. Meeting number one on November 9th, Jets 2-for-4 on the power play. Meeting number two, Jets 3-for-4 on the power play. So they had some power play success against the Avs, and we talked about their lackluster penalty kill. And what do they always say, Drew? Your best penalty killer has to be your goaltender.
Yeah. Well, nothing about the Avalanche goaltending has been the best at all. And so that's the sort of the mentality that the Avalanche have to be thinking about, is that they every save they get out of their goaltender is a bonus. Which is a really difficult way to have to mentally go through a hockey game.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what the solution is in Colorado going forward, because you've made this commitment to Grubauer for the next two seasons after this year. Varlamov, like I said, is a UFA. You wonder, does this cost Jared Bednar his job? Probably.
Really? You think?
I would think so.
He's in year three or year two?
He would be in year three now.
Right.
Remember, he took the job 3 years ago after Patrick Waugh quit sort of late in the summer. And that first year was sort of a mulligan. That was the year that they were...
Atrocious. And now they're back to being atrocious.
And then they were good last year. They were a playoff team last year. And then this year they're back to just being in this tailspin. I don't know. And it's not that it... the goaltending isn't necessarily his fault. That's on Joe Sakic for making poor personnel decisions, but have the young players on the Avs, with the exception of MacKinnon and Rantanen and Landeskog, have the young players developed? Have they taken that leap under Jared Bednar?
Yeah, and
not in my book. You've got guys like JT Compher or Tyson Jost. All these guys, I think, have not had the years that anyone expected from them. It's been injuries to some extent. That's certainly factored into it. But remember, he was their head coach at Lake Erie. When they won the AHL championship, he thought that they were going to that was going to lead them. He was the head coach of the Columbus Blue Jackets affiliate, and he was hired in order to take these young players to their next step. And I don't think he's gotten enough out of the young players, which is why they're such a top heavy team.
Yeah, and just Tyson Jost was sent back down to the AHL. I mean, recently recalled, but yeah, mm-hmm. it's been an up and down season for him. And you talk about guys, yeah, like JT Compher, even a Matt Calvert, you know, a grinder guy that can somewhat put the puck in the net. Carl Soderberg. I mean, these are players that need to pick up some of the slack, and it's just not happening.
Yeah, and that's got to be concerning for Joe Sakic. Now, I don't think Joe Sakic, by any stretch of the imagination, has done a good job in his personnel role with the Colorado Avalanche.
He said he's not trading his picks, though. He's standing by those picks.
Sure, why would you trade Jack Hughes?
Yeah, exactly.
You're the Avs right now. You're going to end up with you're going to have a lot of balls in the ping pong lottery.
You're either getting Capo Kako. Did I get that right? Or
yeah,
Kako Capo.
Yeah, the Finnish player who's going to go second overall. I mean, you have the Senators' draft choice, mm-hmm. wherever that ends up landing after the lottery. You right now, the way the tailspin you're in, I know you're only 4 points out of a playoff
spot.
Could
they get both?
They could. You could finish first and second in the lottery. The way they're, I mean, you know, they're 4 points behind the Wild, but at the same time, they're also only 4 points behind out of the basement in the Western Conference. It's hard to believe for a team that for the first 6 weeks of the season, even the first 8 weeks of the season, was right up at the top.
It's ugly. There's no doubt about that.
It's ugly in Colorado. We'll talk about it up next with a guy who covers the Colorado Avalanche. That's AJ Haefeli. Covers the team for bsndenver.com. He joins us next to talk more about the Jets' opponent tomorrow evening. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on tsn1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour. Welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor with you in studio. This segment of the show brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center. Dr. Rikus and his team provide modern and comprehensive dental care for the whole family. To make an appointment today, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to be joined now by AJ Haefeli. AJ covers the Colorado Avalanche as editor-in-chief of bsndenver.com. The Avalanche, of course, in Winnipeg to play the Jets tomorrow night, a game you can hear live on TSN Radio 1290. AJ, good evening, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. It's good to be talking with you.
Yes, our pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us, AJ. Obviously, the Avs are in town tomorrow to face the Jets, and this is a Colorado Avalanche team that is in an absolute tailspin and has been really since the new year, almost going back. I think it almost started or maybe began to take root with the loss to the Jets, and then the next game they lost to the Calgary Flames, and Nathan MacKinnon and Jared Bednar had their blow up on the bench. You know, is it just simply a matter of the goaltending? I mean, we look at the numbers of Grubauer and Varlamov, and the numbers are just horrendous. How difficult is it for these players to play knowing that their goaltending is giving them absolutely nothing?
You know, it's certainly difficult because if you go back, really the stretch started in the first week of December when they had a four-game road trip out east. And that's when the goaltending really started to fall apart. They gave up 6 goals in a game in Pittsburgh, and then a couple nights later, 7 goals in a game against Tampa Bay. And we all kind of wrote it off at the time because it was like, oh, those are two pretty good teams. It's a long road trip, blah, 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 blah. Excuse, excuse, excuse. And then you fast forward 2 months, and that was really just kind of a sign of things to come for this team is they just haven't gotten any kind of quality goaltending, even though their shot generation, shot suppression, all of that stuff has been in the top 10 of the NHL over the last couple of months. They're playing the right way for the most part, a little too undisciplined for their own good at times, but their process has been pretty good. I mean, you guys remember the last time they were in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. They outplayed the Jets pretty handily, but the goaltending betrayed all the effort, and that's been a consistent theme for the team over the last couple of months. Is, you know, those guys have just totally let down everybody. You know, all the guys on the ice in front of them. Those two goalies, they just trade off letting in 4 goals a night, and nothing ever seems to change with either one of them.
AJ, are you hearing any accountability out of the goaltenders? I mean, have they talked about their performance, or is it kind of just, you know, the cliche answers that we're used to getting out of the, you know, player scrums?
You know, I've talked to Varley a couple of times, and he said, you know, yeah, I've been terrible. I need to turn this around. But they're not making any changes to the process and their preparation and how they're going about it. They for some unholy reason believe in what they're trying to do. I'm not sure why. It's not something that's shown to be overly effective. Certainly not this season. So I'm not sure why they're so comfortable with the process when the results have consistently not been there from those guys. I don't talk to Grubauer as much. He's, you know, he just doesn't play nearly as often. But his problems are just as random, you know, although he really hasn't ever gotten going in Colorado since he came over in the deal in July, or I guess the end of June. And, you know, Varley had a really good start to the season this year, and it was, you know, it was buoyed by a really strong finish to the year last year, where you started to feel like, hey, Varley's healthy, he's rocking and rolling. You know, he got better every single month last year, and then he came out of the gate really hot this year, and you're thinking, great, you know, Varley's back, he's the guy, and Colorado's going to cruise to the postseason in back-to-back years for the first time since Joe Sakic was playing. This is going to be, you know, this is going to be a stress-free season. And then out of the blue, you know, Varley shut out Detroit on December 2nd. And it's been all downhill from there. And there hasn't been any kind of rhyme or reason why. I don't know what it is, other than goalies are voodoo and nobody has any idea what's going on with these guys.
AJ Hayfully is our guest on NHL This Week. AJ is the editor-in-chief of BSNDenver.com. He covers the Colorado Avalanche, who are in town to face the Jets tomorrow evening. You know, AJ, you talk about the goaltending, and you know, Varlamov, of course, is an unrestricted free agent at season's end. And the expectation when they made the trade for Grubauer is they signed him to a 3-year deal. He would just seamlessly take over from Varlamov as the Avalanche, you know, goaltender of the future, or goaltender of the present, I guess. You know, how obviously with the season he's having, you can't just anoint him as the number one goaltender next year. How big of an organizational concern is this that you have really no number one goaltender on the books for next season?
Oh, it's certainly a major concern, you know, and there are some intriguing guys, you know, but Sergei Bobrovsky is going to be a free agent, and given Colorado's affinity for Russian players over the last few years, It's a fair assumption that, you know, if things don't get better in Colorado and he hits the open market, the Avalanche are going to give that guy a call. And it's, you know, there's nothing certain in Colorado right now, especially at the goaltender position, where everything is kind of up in the air. You know, it's right now, I think it's the number one question that the Avalanche have. You know, everybody feels good about the defense, you know, moving forward, that there's a lot of talent there, and there's a lot of talent on the way. The forwards, it's a fair assumption that the forwards will get a little bit better over the next couple of years. It's really just goaltending. What do you do with that position? And obviously, it's not a small question. It doesn't really matter what kind of forward or defensive group you build. If you can't get good goaltending, you know, it's going to betray all of that, you know, and certainly you guys know that as well as anybody after the years that you guys have had to suffer through. And then Hellebuck shows up, and you guys are great. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Avs don't have a Connor Hellebuck in their system right now, so they can't even really look to internal options and say, hey, we're excited about this kid that just hasn't. You know, they draft a goalie every year, and it just doesn't really seem to matter for them. They haven't been able to develop their own starting goaltender in the entire time that they've been in Colorado, and that doesn't look like that's going to end anytime soon. So what they do with the goaltender position, honestly, your guys' guess is going to be as good as mine on that one. Right now, I would say the most likely course of action, just because Sakic is kind of a know your evil kind of guy, that, you know, there's as good a chance that Varley will come back again next year, because he's a known quantity and they're comfortable with him. And I'm not sure which of the other 30 teams in the NHL are looking at Semyon Varlamov right now and banging down his door come July 1st.
AJ, I'm curious, prior to yesterday's 5-2 loss to the Maple Leafs, it was three straight overtime losses for the Avs. Is that more frustrating or less frustrating for a team that they're close to a win, but they don't get it? Or, conversely, they were so close, but they just let it slip away.
Given that they're now 1-11 in overtime, it's going to be kind of crazy that I say this, but the three overtime losses that they had in the last week were the most encouraging overtime losses they've had all year. Each one of them, Colorado had extensive puck possession. They had opportunities to win it. They didn't take a dumb penalty. They didn't shoot themselves in the foot until the very end of the Washington game when guys ran into each other behind the net, and it led to a Kuznetsov breakaway. But it took 4 minutes for that to happen, and honestly, that felt like progress. The Avs have lost something like five of their overtime games in the first minute this year, so for them to have at least been competitive in those three overtime games in the last week, it felt like progress. That's where things are for us in Colorado right now, is that felt like progress, to lose those games, to get points out of them, but not to have been embarrassed in overtime. It felt like a step forward. Everybody was feeling kind of good after that road trip because it was like, hey, something to build on. And then, they went out in the game last night against Toronto and completely folded up shop. So it's a tough go of things in Denver right now.
AJ Hayfley is our guest on NHL this week. We're talking about the Colorado Avalanche. AJ is the editor-in-chief of BSNDenver.com, who covers the Avalanche. Who's got more pressure on their shoulders? Whose seat is hotter right now in Denver? Is it Jared Bednar or is it Joe Sakic?
Well, there's not really ever been any evidence that ownership understands that they own the Avalanche. So I'm not entirely sure that there's anybody above Joe Sakic actually paying attention. So I would definitely
Walmart
say Jared
you got to watch
right
Walmart.
Now.
It takes more attention to watch Walmart.
Well, those guys are just fresh off their NFL team losing in the Super Bowl, so they're still pretty. They've got to be riding pretty high right now.
Yeah.
But all jokes aside, it's definitely got to be Jared Bednar. His first year as an NHL coach, he puts up a 48 point season. Hey, there were a lot of mitigating circumstances to that. It was a tough go. Everybody was pretty understanding of that, and everybody would have been understanding had they moved on. 48 point season is an impossible feat. You couldn't try to build a team that bad. And yet they did it, and he survived. And then he comes back last year, a 95-point year, and, hey, he gets the one-year extension, so, he's now got his contract running through the end of next season. But if they miss the postseason again this year and they don't turn this thing around and even make it competitive down the stretch, if Bednar survives, his assistant coaches can't. There's got to be some sort of change. You can't just go in and say, everything is cool. there's got to be some sort of accountability. There's got to be some sort of example of the front office having a pulse and understanding that this isn't going to continue to be okay. It's easy for a guy like me to sell the fan base on the merits of the future and how there are a lot of exciting young guys that are coming up and that they've got lots of cap space. They can go out and they can sign guys in free agency this summer, and they can make themselves competitive again pretty quickly. But ultimately, the management in the front office has to show that they understand that this isn't okay, that something's got to change. And if they don't get this turned around, as much as I personally like Jared Bednar, and I don't necessarily think he's the problem, it's a lot easier to fire a coach than it is to trade 23 guys.
AJ, have you noticed any top-line fatigue as the season plays on? So much was made about how top-heavy the Avs were at the beginning of the season. Is that top line slowing down at all, or are they really just not getting the secondary scoring necessary?
Well, they lost to Toronto last night, and the top line had two shots on goal.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a pretty tough go of it. They scored the only goal in Boston, but that was just the one goal. They didn't do anything against the Islanders. So, I would definitely say, yeah, there's definitely been some fatigue. Gabe Landeskog is in the middle of a career year. The last goal he scored was January 19th against the Kings, which is the last time the Avalanche won a game. So, the top line has really, they've significantly slowed down. But the secondary scoring continues to be a bit of an issue. though, you know, if you look at the bottom nine forwards as secondary scoring and then, you know, all six defensemen, all of those guys have been able to combine for a goal or two most nights. And the top line just isn't quite getting it done at the level that they were. And obviously, you know, all those guys were on pace for 120-plus point seasons. They weren't all going to continue that. You know, it's not 1986 anymore. So, you know, that was an unreasonable expectation for that kind of craziness to continue. But they've really fallen off. Like, they just have. They've slowed significantly. And not only that, but they are the primary culprits for goals scored against. They're on the ice for more goals against than anybody else during this eight-game losing streak. They've defensively been nothing short of a disaster. And given the way that Blake Wheeler kind of owns the Avalanche, it's hard to believe that tomorrow night is going to be any different.
Last question for you, AJ. AJ Hayfully of BSN Denver is our BSNDenver.com. Pardon me, is our guest talking about the Avalanche. Trade deadline day is 12 days away. The Avalanche are not a playoff team. They're not officially eliminated. They have a couple of pending unrestricted free agents. How does Joe Sakic approach trade deadline day, to your mind?
Well, historically speaking, he may not even know that it's going on. I mean, he's been one of the most inactive GMs at the deadline over the last couple of years. You know, 2 years ago, they were out of the playoff race by the end of December, and they made, I think, exactly two deals at the deadline. So, you know, and you don't get any more of a seller standpoint than a 48-point team. You know, a team that lost 60 games.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do much of anything then. He didn't do much of anything last year. He made one AHL swap, and that was it. He hasn't shown any kind of an affinity for getting rid of guys on expiring contracts for draft picks. You know, a guy like Colin Wilson is a great example of that this year. Of course, Wilson getting hurt as he did last weekend could really complicate that. But I would like to believe that Sakic's going to be more aggressive this year. Just because, you know, being around the team and talking to the people and talking to people around the league, it certainly sounds like there's a lot of talk that the Avalanche could be significantly more active than they have been the last couple of years. But it's on Sakic to prove it, honestly, just simply because he hasn't done it before. So it's on him to step up and to kind of change his MO and his approach at the deadline. And I think he should really embrace the idea of, hey, even if we're going to make a playoff run, Colin Wilson is not going to be the difference. Sven Andrighetto is not going to be the difference. Patrick Nemeth is not going to be the difference. These are all guys on expiring contracts that other teams might have value for, and they might, you know, they might make a play for. You know, Carl Soderberg might be a guy that could make sense in Winnipeg. You know, he's a guy who's played his heart out, and his numbers don't look as good because he's been tied to a couple of boat anchors for the last, you know, 3 months. So offensively, his numbers are a little depressed, but that's a guy that would make a lot of sense for a contender to come calling about. And Sakic should not be at the point where he says, hey, these guys are untouchable. He should be very open to dealing some of these guys and be willing to move on. It should be more active of a deadline than it likely will be, given his history.
AJ Hayfully covers the Colorado Avalanche for BSNDenver.com. The Avs in town to play the Jets tomorrow evening, a game you can hear live on TSN 1290. AJ, always appreciate your time and insight. Thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Appreciate you guys having me on. Enjoy the game tomorrow.
Likewise, AJ. Thanks again. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290. When we come back, we discuss Randy Carlyle being dismissed in Anaheim. General manager Bob Murray goes behind the bench. So far, it's a 1-0 lead for the Ducks, so it's a great decision. That's coming up next. More on the Ducks. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Okay, now to some not-so-surprising news. The Ducks have finally fired Randy Carlyle. 2 months ago, Carlyle signed an extension. Then the tailspin began. Last month, GM Bob Murray gave him a vote of confidence. They've lost 19 of 21, falling from second in the Pacific all the way to last in the West. Now it's Murray, who has no coaching experience, who is taking over behind the bench.
That was from our friends at TSN. So you're telling me that losing 19 of 21 games isn't a good recipe for success? That's what the Anaheim Ducks did. I mean, it's actually merciful that Randy Carlyle, I mean, lost his job. It's hard to believe that that's something you say, but it was getting to the point where you had to, where continuing to string him along or to let this situation fester. I mean, not that I think Bob Murray is going to turn things around here. I don't think that all of a sudden, I don't think Randy Carlyle was the problem. I think it's a flawed roster. But whatever he was preaching just certainly had stopped getting through to the Anaheim Ducks players. Welcome back to NHL This Week. We're live here on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor with you in studio. This segment of the show brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. I mean, these are not numbers that you can put up in this day and age in the NHL.
Nope.
The numbers the Ducks are putting up about losing 19 games in their last 21, that's not possible.
No.
The numbers that the Colorado Avalanche were putting up. We were just talking to AJ Hayfley last segment. What they've been doing since New Year's. The NHL is designed in this day and age to not let teams go on losses of this regard. The Anaheim Ducks. You remember, the overtime loss here in Winnipeg. Then they finally got those. They finally snapped that losing streak in Minnesota, and they won two games. And then they just started another losing streak. I mean, that game wasn't last Saturday. It was two Saturdays ago now. When it was 6-0 after 20 minutes. I mean, those are players quitting.
It's unimaginable when you look at a scoreboard and you see it's after 20 minutes and it's 6-0 in an NHL game.
I can understand it on one-offs. Team played the night before, they had plane troubles, they didn't arrive into wherever they were going until 5 in the morning.
6-0?
Well, 6-0 is pretty dramatic, fair enough. If it's a one-off, you shove it aside, you burn the tape, you say, it's a scheduled loss, we didn't have a chance.
Forget it, boys. We'll see you in the film room tomorrow, but forget about it. But, I mean, yeah.
It's the lack of pride of some really senior hockey players. And I know that Ryan Getzlaff isn't Ryan Getzlaff, and Ryan Kesler isn't Ryan Kesler, and these guys are all getting older, and these guys are all a step and a half slower than they once were. But
a lot of miles on those cars.
And it's a flawed roster, and Bob Murray deserves the blame for that, for giving too much money to veteran players. And
flooded with no movement clauses. Also, Perry, Getzlaff, Kesler, all no movement clauses. So, I mean, it's not going to be easy moving those guys, especially with the contracts that they have as well.
Yeah, they have no cap space.
No, everything salary about, cap hell is what the quote was, I believe I read.
Yeah, everything about it is absolutely terrible right now. I mean, everything about it, and I don't expect this team to turn it around anytime soon. You just can't. When you have Perry at $8.6 million, and Getzlaff at $8.25, and Kesler at $6.8, and Henrique, whose five-year contract doesn't even kick in until next season, and he's having a terrible year, and he's about to be 30 years old.
I was thinking about this. You think Bob Murray is evaluating more than the players? You think he's looking at the coaching? You think he's doing a deep dive? Maybe even the trainers? He wants to look at all areas personnel of this team. I mean, a full evaluation.
It's
assistant coaches.
The team needs an entire organizational reset. The problem is, so Dallas Eakins is going to be their next head coach. I'd be surprised if he's not. Mm-hmm. He's the head coach of the San Diego Gulls. And I think Dallas Eakins has learned a lot since he failed as a head coach in Edmonton. I think he's learned that how he necessarily treated the players in Edmonton, you can't treat them that way as a professional head coach. I think Dallas Eakins was probably arrogant because he was the hot thing coming over. Remember, he was the Marlies head coach.
Remember what he did to the media? He made it a completely healthy environment.
Yeah,
took away like the donuts.
You can't control players like that. It's just not a thing that happens, and not realistic. He was the hot head coach. They hired him from the Toronto Marlies. He went to Edmonton. It was a disaster in Edmonton. He's gone to San Diego. He's done a good job. And they got a lot of young talent. The problem is all that young talent is going to come up. But they still have these boat anchors. I mean, that's what Ryan Kesler is at this stage of his career. That's what Corey Perry is at this stage of their career. It's not like San Jose. Remember San Jose? I mean, Joe Thornton, even Patrick Marleau before he went to the Leafs, they were still contributing. And then the Pavelskis and the Coutures came, and the Timo Meyers and the Thomas Hurdles came in and sort of took over the leadership on that team.
Mm-hmm.
And Thornton maybe took a step back because Joe Thornton didn't need to be the superstar player. And Thornton had the personality where he can handle that. I don't know that Getzlaff and Perry and Kesler have that personality where they can agree to sort of take on that secondary role, be a supporting cast player for the Troy Terrys, for the Max Joneses, for the guys who are coming up through the system of the Anaheim Ducks. I don't know. I mean, Bob Murray seems like he's secure in his job as general manager. I'm not sure why that is the case. I mean, you look at the contracts he signed, they're atrocious. I mean, honestly, with all due respect to Randy Carlyle, who obviously never wants to get fired and nobody ever wants to lose their job, I have to believe that deep down, there's almost a bit of a sense of relief. Yeah,
he got that message and just kind of put his feet up and took a deep breath and went, I'm out of here.
Well, you know, and I wonder if Randy Carlyle is ever going to get another head coaching job.
Well, yeah, is that the end of the line? Is that how the career ends?
This is a guy who is better suited for a veteran team.
Or does he coach Edmonton next year?
He's sort of old school. He's in his early 60s now. He's definitely better a coach for a veteran team more than a young team. I think this is probably it. And he's had a fantastic career in and around the NHL.
Mm-hmm.
He's been a fantastic, he's a fantastic coach for the Anaheim Ducks. He is a fantastic player in the NHL. If this is the end of the line, so be it. He's going to go out with a golden parachute and he'll do very well for himself. And he can take a job as a pro scout or whatever and work when he wants to work and golf when he wants to golf and do whatever. But it is sort of a disappointing end to a career that you had to be saddled with the season that is right now with the Anaheim Ducks. Very quickly, Sean.
The Ducks are so bad that they are just pulling. They're playing the nostalgia game right now. The only resort is calling the old Anaheim or the old Mighty Ducks from the Disney movie, getting them back in those jerseys and getting them involved in the promotions part of the season.
The Ducks are wearing their throwback old stool.
Mighty Ducks dropped the puck tonight.
Oh, that's good. They were available. Let me tell you.
Yeah, Karp and Averman were there.
Yeah. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Dennis Bernstein of the Fourth Period. Talk more about the Ducks. Talk more about the wasteland that is Southern California hockey this season. You're listening to NHL This Week, hour number two up next on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN Radio 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Sean Assor. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From thefourthperiod.com, we're pleased to welcome to the program Dennis Bernstein. Dennis is a senior writer for that fine publication. Dennis, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Drew and Sean, great to talk to you. I guess we can have both a Ginsburg and a Bernstein on tonight, so I'm happy to step in.
That's great
to talk to you. Do a great show. I mean, I love the show, so I'm happy to be on the for the first time.
We appreciate it, Dennis. And yes, our good friend Ezra Ginsberg is under the weather and wishes that he was here with us, but we're perfectly fine with him not being here. Dennis, we're watching in studio. We're watching the Anaheim Ducks play right now. And yeah, while they may have the lead, it's looking very much like more of the same, as you alluded in sending us a tweet earlier this evening. You know, when Randy Carlyle was dismissed, was it at the point where it was almost a merciful decision by Ducks general manager Bob Murray?
Yeah, it was too late. Yes, it was merciful because the team, if you watch this team for more than one consecutive game, you see they just basically quit on him, or there wasn't really any life in this team. But he waited way too long, Murray, to make this change. I mean, I can go back to right after the Christmas break. They played three games against the Atlantic Division. They played Florida, Tampa, and Carolina. Won all three games and got outshot by 37 shots in all combined in all three games. I think, okay, this team, when they were doing well, was all in the back of John Gibson. And because of the volumes of shots and because John Gibson always seems to get hurt every season, the team collapsed when he wasn't playing well and ultimately got injured. So, yeah, it was a mercy killing here. But when you watch this team play tonight, I mean, we're about 7 minutes to go in the second period. They have nine shots against that shutdown Vancouver defense. I mean, I'm definitely kidding about that shutdown Vancouver defense. There's a lot to fix here, guys. And I think just Bob Murray going down behind the bench is not going to really fix anything. He wants to get close to the team. You know, when he made this decision, he was over in Europe scouting. So I'm not sure how important this was, or like he was waiting and waiting and waiting. He went over to Europe with scouting, had to come back, went to the owners, and that's the story he's giving, and decided to pull the plug on Randy. But there's a lot to fix here. I'm not sure it could be done in one offseason, or certainly with him keeping a close eye on his team from right behind the bench.
Yeah, Dennis, it's interesting that, you know, Bob Murray going behind the bench. We were kind of trying to make sense of the whole situation prior to having you on. And my thought is he's looking at more than just the team. He wants a deeper look into, you know, the training staff, the assistant coaches, you know, all aspects of his team right now, more so than just the players.
Yeah, you know, I think there's an ego involved too, guys. So let's be real. Like, his first game coaching is tonight. Right? Mm-hmm. He could have elevated Mark Morrison, who's a really good coach, made him the interim head coach, and Bob could have been the interim assistant coach to look. I mean, Bob doesn't know how to change. He's going to be leaning on these guys anyway. So the ego that's involved here with respect to how he did the firing and how I'm going to go behind him, I mean, you could have been a bystander, let a real coach who's been coaching this team coach all year. So for me, that's a little bit problematic. Plus, I'll be honest with you, if he elevated an assistant coach to interim coach, you have to pay him more. I'm not sure this franchise wants to pay anybody anymore. So he goes behind the bench, not paying another coach. So, but I agree with you. I think he's looking for who's the core of this team, right? Who's really trying? And if you watch tonight, Getzlaf got into a fight. Kessler got into a fight, although Kessler is a shadow of what he once was. So he's certainly not a core player anymore. But I think he's looking for that. He's looking for the five or six players who responds over the last 26 games or 27 games of the season. And so when he goes forward, he can say, okay, these are the players I want. These are the players I can move. And the one saving grace for this team, and you guys know this very, very well, this organization can find and develop talent. The youngsters they have in San Diego are really good. You see tonight, Max Jones is up, Maxime Comtois, Sam Steele, Troy Terry. They have more in the pipeline. So that's the one saving grace. If you're going to look at a silver lining here, you're going to look at their development and how they select and develop players. So that's the one thing I look at. But I agree with you. He's looking at who really is the core of this team, who he can keep and who he can send away in the offseason.
Dennis Bernstein of thefourthperiod.com is our guest on NHL this week. We're talking about the Anaheim Ducks as they go through a period of transition. And Dennis, you mentioned all those prospects, the Troy Terrys, the Sam Steeles, the Max Jones. And you know, I sort of look back to the San Jose Sharks a couple of years ago where they had a bit of a changing of the guard, where the role of Joe Sakic and the role of Patrick Marleau when he was still there sort of lessened, and then the role of the Joe Pavelskis and the Logan Couture's and the Thomas Hurdles, I guess, more this year, and then the Timo Meyers, again, more this year, sort of has increased. I look at guys like Perry and Kessler and Getzlaf, and I'm not sure that they can sort of handle that changing of the guard. Being closer to the situation there, what do you think those guys will handle, sort of that influx of youth that's going to come in with the next wave of Anaheim Ducks players?
Well, you have to figure out if they're so firmly entrenched living in Southern California, living in Newport Beach, making $7-8 million a year. If Bob Murray decided that, Corey Perry, I think that Getzlaf is still going to be part of the core. But Corey Perry, right? He would have to retain some size. Would Corey Perry want to leave Southern California where his family lives and he's firmly entrenched to go play in Carolina or in, I don't know, in Nashville? I don't think so. That's the other problem, is that Bob handed out these contracts with no movement clauses. I don't think that, like, I know that Ryan Kessler's not going to go easy into the night, right? He's going to be feisty, and he's not going to be. And I think there was a faction of, in the room between a Getzlaff and a Kessler, where some guys sided with Ryan and thought that Kessler should have been the leader all along, and some still thought Getzlaff should have been. So this is going to be problematic, because it's not a simple situation where you can say to Corey, hey, by the way, you know, we traded you to Carolina for your first and second round pick. Not that he's worth that anyway. So I think that's problematic as well. So I think that Getzlaff would be a good guy to lead this team and the youngsters. I'm not sure about Perry and Kessler. A reduced role, Kessler is not the player he once was. He's not even close to that anymore. So there's going to be challenges with respect to the leadership. So that goes against, that goes back again to Bob Murray and what he can do to establish leadership. Because when this team was going bad, guys, and they've gone bad for a long time, right? I think they lost 19 to 21. The leadership in the room did nothing to stem the tide. And you could blame the coach all you want or the general manager putting together a shaky roster, but at some point in time, the players and the leaders in the room that are making that big money have to stand up and say, we have to right the ship, because there is talent on this team. It didn't happen. So, again, it goes back to not just the on-ice production and the results. It's like, who's leading this team when you get into a tailspin? And tonight they've lost, they're coming in losing seven in a row. There's just no response here. So you got to look at the guys who wear the letters on their sweaters and say, hey, it's up to you guys to turn this around.
Yeah, that's the part that I find so amazing, Dennis, is that
guys,
you know, we know that Corey Perry is a shadow of himself, and we know that Ryan Kessler is a shadow of the shadow of himself. But, you know, these were guys who were perennial champions, they were perennial Olympians, they were perennial, you know, Stanley Cup contenders. And the lack of pride that they've shown is what I find to be amazing. I mean, you know, the game here 2 weeks ago where you're down 6-0 you know, after 20 minutes. That doesn't happen in this day and age in the NHL unless players are just quitting. And to have the pedigree that these players have, and they're just absolutely quitting. They're not even starting to play the game. They're just quitting from before the game begins. It is just so hard to believe when you could think back to what these players once were.
And I think the most mystifying thing about that particular game in Winnipeg is that was coming out of the break. So you think, okay, this team had a rough go. They went away, the All-Star game, they had a few days off, they went on the beach, wherever, hung out with their friends. They're going to come back energized. And you're right. How many times do we see 6-0? Not three, not 6-0 in the first period. You never see that.
No.
I mean, never, ever. And it goes to the pride of this team. And so, but that was a few weeks ago. I mean, after that game, I fire Andy Carlisle, if I'm Bob Murray. I'm not giving him any more. Like, oh, this team is a second-half team. They can turn it around. Like, have you been watching this team at all for the last 6 weeks? Don't tell me they're a second-half team. The team maybe 3 years ago was, or maybe last year was. This team was never going to turn it around. So why you waited and waited and waited, and I'll dovetail into the discussion where they have these kids down in San Diego, and they have the coach down there, Dallas Eakins, right? But we don't want to bring them up because that might affect the losing opportunity that they got a good thing going in the AHL, want to keep going. I looked at the standings tonight. They're in third place in the Pacific. They're not, like, running away with the league. I mean, Bakersfield's won 10 in a row. This is the perfect time to install Dallas Eakins, to get his systems going for next season, to build on it. This is the perfect time to have a Troy Terry, a Max Jones, and the rest of those youngsters go through adversity. And the clincher for me, guys, is when you look at the roster tonight and you see players like Devin Shore and Nick Ritchie and Carter Rowney and Brian Gibbons, and you look at Derek Grant, like, those players are so ultimately replaceable. There's no excuse to not start the process now. You have the coach that you know you're probably going to hire down there in San Diego. You have the players that need the growth, that need the opportunity to play in the AHL, and you're saying you don't want to inject them into a negative losing atmosphere. That's how you grow. That's how you grow personalities, when you're losing and you're facing all these issues in the NHL. There's no time like the present to get this new regime and new players in, and they're not going to do it. They're going to go through and go to the last 27 games. They're not going to make the playoffs. And the fans, which I feel sorry for, are going to watch Devin Shore and Nick Ritchie skate around the ice, not score goals. They're going to continue to lose games. To me, what Bob's done here is he's locked up a team with bad contracts. He doesn't want to move forward with the youngsters that are quality and could produce going forward at the training camp and start up next season. It just baffles me the way he's handled all this. And the cherry on the top of the sundae is he's going to go behind the bench as the head coach. It just, this whole process Bob's come through in the last year, the people that said he should and Randy should have been fired at the end of last season when they went out 4 in the playoffs against San Jose, those people look real right tonight.
Dennis, it reminds me of when I was in elementary school and a teacher would get sick, and rather than call in a substitute teacher for our class, they would just bring in the principal,
right.
just to kind of see who the real troublemakers were. And, you know, I'm not pointing any direction at myself, but a fair analogy almost.
A very fair analogy. I don't know what Bob's doing coaching Mike. He's never coached a game in his life. He's going to put on the skates and he's overseas and getting on the ice. I get the upfront and looking at it. But let Morrison or another assistant coach run the team, and you stand there on the bench and just look at guys. And then you don't have to worry about line changes and all this other stuff. Let's be honest, guys. This is guaranteed money. You think Ryan Kessler really cares what Bob Murray's looking at? Like, you think that's any motivation to him? Oh, I got to put – now he got into a fight tonight, so good for him. But there's no extra motivation with these guys making $7 million with no movement clauses. Like, they know they're locked in. So I don't get it. I don't understand it. Maybe it's the second-tier players like Adam Henrique, who, by the way, that deal for almost $6 million next year, and he's a 41 – he's projecting 41 points. That deal looks bad. Yeah. The Silverberg, I wouldn't bring him back. There's so many bad deals on this team. Raquel's got 9 goals, and I know they've been banged up with injuries, but Bob has a lot to fix. I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure he's the guy to fix it.
That was going to be my next question, Bob. Dennis, is Bob Murray the guy to fix this team, given that he's the one who's painted them into this corner? I mean, why is there confidence that, you know, he knows how to handle the salary cap, that he knows how to extricate the organization from the disaster that he is almost responsible for?
Oh, he doesn't, but he's got a 2-year extension. And then I know this organization, they're not going to pay 2 coaches. They're not going to pay 2 GMs. Right? If I was the owners, I would have been asking for Carlisle's head in November or December when I saw this. But they're the hands-off owners. They're good people. They live in Orange County. They're really involved in the community. They're billionaires. I get all that. But there's no movement here. There's not going to be. They're not going to pay another GM to do Bob's job. They just extended them. So I think that's part of the issue. Do I think he's the guy? I don't. When I look at all the handcuffs, you look at next season, I think they have $71 million already dedicated against the cap on 15 players. I mean, what are you going to do? And 3 guys have no movement clauses that are anchor contracts. What can you do here? You can pray that these young kids come up and produce on entry-level contracts. That's a pretty, you know, that's a really big novena you're asking for, I think, next season. So I don't think he's the guy, but I don't think he's going anywhere. I think he'll get 2 seasons to try to figure it out. I don't think this team is going to progress because they are getting older, and with that, you know, $25, $27 million worth of cap between 3 players, that's a major challenge. I don't see how he extricates himself from that. And even a guy like Henrique has a 10-team no-trade clause. And he has no-trade clauses like candy in this organization. I think it's really come back to haunt him.
Dennis, in your opinion, who garners the best return at the trade deadline?
Yeah. I'm thinking Cam Fowler, but here's the thing. I really think if you really think you're going to be a contender in a couple of seasons, I think you've got to keep Cam here. Like $6.5 million, reasonable hit for a top-pair defenseman. He's 27 years old. I wouldn't trade Hampus Lindholm because I think he's probably the best player. I think you got to look at the defenseman. I think of Josh Manson. And the thing is, Josh Manson and Brandon Montour have regressed this season. So it's the same thing that's going on in Los Angeles. When you have a bad season, it craters everybody's trade value. I think the most return you probably come at Josh Manson or Brandon Montour. I mean, and probably Montour because he's 24 years old. He's got another season left before he's an arbitration eligible RFA. I think that would be the kid to get you some return. The forwards, I don't know. I would be trading Silverberg at the deadline, but you're probably going to get a mid-level pick for him. The rest of the forwards, I just don't see it. You can't trade Raquel. Henrique's probably not tradable as well. So I think you got to look at their defense, which is they always trade from the defense, right, guys? So I got to think Brandon Montour would probably get the best return at this point in time because of his age, and he's about a $3.4 million cap hit for next season as well.
Well, hey, Dennis, at least it's a historic night in California tonight because Bob Murray becomes the oldest first-time coach in NHL history at 64. So, you know, something to celebrate.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, you'd be grateful for little things tonight. But then, and the Mighty Ducks showed up. The cast and the Mighty Ducks at the game before the opening faceoff. So that's it. But yeah, it's a mess here. And with John Gibson injured, I think it makes it even worse because now you've got, you know, a good kid in Kevin Boyle who's 26 years old who's played well only actually in the game and a half he's played in. But there's injuries. The team is older, and like I said, the salary cap situation really hamstrings Bob Murray. So it's going to be a. If Bob can extricate himself from this, then he's going to be the executive of the year next season.
Dennis, we'll let you go on this last question. It's, you know, sort of everyone expects that Dallas Eakins will be named the new head coach of the Anaheim Ducks. He's had tremendous success at the AHL level. His stint in Edmonton as the Oilers head coach didn't go well. Mm-hmm. Is he the right coach? Sort of he's not a veteran coach. He's in his early 50s. Is he the right coach to get through to guys like Perry and Getzlaff and Kessler? We know that he can do well with the younger players, but, you know, what kind of coach is the right coach to get through to those guys?
Well, I don't think it would be a guy like Joel Quenneville, right? Because he's not going to step into this mess.
No.
Right? You're set up to lose here. And I think even though you mentioned Aiken's age, I think he's better set up to win now. He can't worry about those veterans. He's got to worry about getting through to the kids who he's been working with in San Diego. I think that's what Bob has got to focus in. If he can move one of those three veterans and probably Perry next season, move them out. I think Getzlaff's still dedicated. You're going to have an issue with Kessler in the locker room. I think that's what you're focused in. I think Eakins is the right type of new age, quote-unquote, type of coach, even though he did fail in Edmonton. I think the league is set up better right now because it's younger and quicker. I think he can succeed here because of his relationship with the team, with the players in San Diego. So I would go forward with him. I wouldn't think to bring in somebody else from the outside. He knows these kids coming up. I think that's the best step for Bob Murray is just to elevate Eakins at the end of the season, and since he has the knowledge of the kids coming through the pipeline.
Dennis Bernstein is with thefourthperiod.com. Dennis, for your first appearance on this program, I must say you hit a grand slam home run. We'll have you on again real soon.
Hey, great talking with you guys up in Winnipeg. Anytime you want me on, I'd be happy to come on. Thanks for the time.
We're going to hold you to that, Dennis. Appreciate it. Thanks again. When we come back, we discuss Evgeny Malkin deciding that he wants to swing his stick executioner style. Did he get the one-game suspension? Is that the right amount? We talk about Evgeny Malkin and his, on-ice proclivities. That's coming up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
This is High Sticking. Malkin has been fined twice in his 835-game NHL career. The Department of Player Safety has suspended Evgeny Malkin for one game.
It was nice of that robot to give that assessment of the Evgeny Malkin
the
suspension.
Jetsons?
Yes. It was high sticking. He's right about that. I mean, it was high sticking. It was almost public execution. It was almost an on-ice beheading. It was all sorts of almost there. Thankfully, he didn't make contact because that would have been, that would have been one of the ugliest on-ice incidents since McSorley and Brashear and... what was his name? Steve Moore and Todd Bertuzzi. We'd be talking about that one if he had made contact for a while. Welcome back to NHL This Week. We're live here on TSN Radio 1290, the segment of the show brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Bernstein's is proudly family-owned and operated and has been serving quality home-style food since 1985. That's a long time, 34 years.
Cool. Quality timeline.
I know. For freshly made and fresh frozen foods delivered right to your door, visit shopbernsteins.com or check them out on the corner of Cordon and Lanark in the Cordon Village Mall, bernsteinsdeli.com. You know, Evgeny Malkin, his comments post-game were amusing. I don't know if you saw the quote, Shawnee.
No,
this is the quote from Evgeny Malkin after the stick swinging incident. Again, he doesn't actually hit Michael Raffel, which is good, but he certainly tries to hit him.
Looked like he was auditioning for the movie Gladiator.
Yeah. This is Malkin's quote. I didn't hit him in the face. If I had touched him in the face, for sure I would get suspended. It's a high stick, but it's not like I broke his face. I think I won't get suspended. He got one game. Does he deserve more for unsuccessfully beheading?
Well, that's the problem, right? The problem is result over intent.
Intent is to chop his head off.
The intent is to smash a player in the face with your stick when you're 6'4", 200-plus pounds, and you're using velocity like we've never experienced, Drew, to swing a blunt object into your opponent's face because you didn't like somewhat of a cheap shot you got to the back of your neck, head area. I mean, we've seen Evgeny Malkin and his lack of, I'd say, discipline when it comes to his stick and stick infractions. I mean, there's multiple compilation videos of this guy just swinging his stick like crazy. Ryan Callahan sticks out to me. There's even video of him faking slashing a fan as he's leaving the ice. So this guy obviously is a hothead.
Yeah.
He's got a temper. We've seen that numerous times throughout his career. He can be agitated.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's I think about the Blake Wheeler incident. I mean, that was a dirty, dirty hit
he's almost taken over from Corey Perry in the very good, very effective player category who's also dirty. I mean, he's sneaky dirty, Evgeny Malkin. And maybe this stick swinging incident is sort of bringing light to just how much of an edge he plays with. It's certainly part of his game. But I mean, this—if he makes contact with Michael Raffel on this play, and I mean, it's—I mean, I don't—I mean,
that's—I
could see it becoming a criminal offense. I don't know that it should, but if he makes contact with Raffel on this, with swinging his stick in the manner that he did, I could see somebody trying to make it out to be a criminal offense.
And just think about the stupidity of the time. I mean, listen, it's always stupid to go after an opponent's head with your stick, right? That is as wrong as it gets in the NHL. But
keep it in the midsection, and we're not talking about
this. You're up 3-0 in the third. You're clinging to a postseason position in a critical time in the season when everyone is jockeying for playoff points.
Mm-hmm.
You're up 3-0 in the third, and you take a 5-minute match penalty, and the Flyers score right away.
Yeah.
Imagine what Mike Sullivan and his teammates are thinking at that moment, where you're just thinking, man, are you kidding me? Like, use your freaking head, not your opponent's head, as a target.
Yeah, it's actually sort of been a bit of a clean year in terms of on-ice discipline. It hasn't been the chaos that we've seen in past seasons where there's just a parade of players in front of NHL Department of Player Safety. There's been an odd one here, an odd one there. Tom Wilson hasn't tried to injure anybody in about a week, so, you know, good for you, Tom.
Well, you see the licking he laid on Ian Cole? Ian Cole will think twice about sticking out the chicken wing again, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, he took Ian Cole to the woodshed. That was last week, right?
Yeah, that was the Washington game.
Yeah, really...
After he elbowed Kuznetsov in the face.
Yeah, Ian Cole got a face. And that's when Tom Wilson's at his most effective.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been good lately in not sort of taking himself off the ice and not you know, causing chaos. But had Malkin connected on this one, I mean, I don't even know how many games you give him for that. You might give him 10, 15.
And that's the worst part to me, because the guy swung his stick at an opponent's head.
Yeah.
And he gets one game because it just clipped the head and didn't result in any major injuries.
Yeah.
That to me is the flawed system of the NHL or one part of.
I honestly don't know what you do. Can you suspend somebody for intent?
If it's at the head with a, I think you almost can. Well, didn't they?
They gave him one game. Can you give him more?
I mean, if you give him one.
You could give him more,
but I mean, they're saying, what, it's his first suspension, so, you know, quote-unquote, first-time offender?
I don't know.
It's garbage.
It's an interesting situation. In any event, I think I'm thinking nobody wants to see what would have happened to Michael Raffel had Malkin connected with that stick. It would have been a real ugly situation.
Remember when Thomas Raffel played for the Moose?
Well, the Jets signed him, and then he had a random... Well, they signed him because, you know, he played well in Austria, and he just had an injury-riddled season with the Moose. He couldn't stay healthy, and I wonder if the Jets, you know, just thought they might be able to get a diamond in the rough and try it out, and it doesn't cost you anything, but he just couldn't stay healthy. Anyways, when we come back, Kevin Woodley of NHL.com and In Goal Magazine is going to join us, talk a little bit about some of the goaltenders and goaltending issues around the NHL. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of hour number two. Welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor with you late night, Wednesday night, the 13th of February. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
For a look around the world of goaltending, we're pleased to welcome back to the program Kevin Woodley of NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. Kevin, good evening. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, guys.
Kevin, you know, we were talking about the Colorado Avalanche earlier in the program. They're going to be in town to face the Jets tomorrow, and we were sort of chuckling because that's almost all you can do when you look at the numbers since, you know, the end of December of Semyon Varlamov and of Philip Grubauer.
Yeah.
Watching those two players, like, what are you seeing of those two goalies? That is there any logic? Is there any reason why those two goalies can't stop anything right now and haven't been able to stop anything for much of the last 7 weeks?
Yeah, I'm a little befuddled by this one, to be honest with you. And truth be told, I haven't had a chance to, you know, sit down and go over hours and hours of tape. So I don't want to, you know, frankly, talk out of my butt. But I will admit that I'm surprised by it. More so Varlamov, to be honest with you. I expected him to take that job and run with it. This is a guy who probably should have won the Vezina in 2014, the year that Tuukka Rask got it. This is a guy who, since he sort of had the hip surgery that fixed a lot of the groin issues, I mean, he has a skill set that I equate to Bobrovsky, frankly, in terms of athleticism, power in his movements, at times too inefficiency in movements, but just pure raw skill. And I'm a little surprised that it's gone south for him and for them as well. Grubauer is capable of more than he's shown. And anytime you see it, you know, it's funny. Like, take a look at around the league. Take a look at some of the tandems that are right there in lockstep statistically, whether it's Bishop and Hudobin, Rask and Halak, Lehner and Greiss on the positive side of the ledger. You look at the Capitals with Holtby and Copley, and now in Colorado, the way it's gone for both of them. And, you know, again, without having a whole bunch of numbers or any sort of deep dive in front of me, you got to wonder if it's just the guys between the pipes when both of them go south like that. Like, I know it's not like their goalie coach forgot how to coach. It's not like these guys forgot how to stop pucks. You wonder if there are things within the system that are leaving them more vulnerable, or mistakes that are made where they're making one read and the puck goes the other way, and that's not necessarily their job. Like, they're sticking with their thing and nobody else is doing theirs. I honestly don't have a complete picture, but anytime both guys go for a spill like that, you got to wonder if it's more than just the goaltenders themselves. And for Colorado, a team that has never been real stout defensively over the past couple of seasons, your tendency, you know, again, I probably shouldn't make this assumption without having put in the work, but your tendency is to think that it's more than just the goaltenders to blame.
Kevin, I want to ask you about Mikey DiPietro. He kind of gets thrust into action against the San Jose Sharks for the Vancouver Canucks, and Timo Meier comes in just over a minute into the game, scores on his first shot as an NHL goaltender. I mean, how great of a test of mental toughness is that for a young goaltender once he gets scored on early in the game on his first shot?
Yeah, you know what? It wasn't even so much the first one as the second one that went in a couple of minutes later. I mean, quite literally a floater backhand from the blue line that's going to sail over the net. And, you know, maybe a sign of nerves and over-anxiousness that he was sort of reaching up for a puck that was headed over the net, and then his defenseman sort of tips it right in front of him doing the same thing, and it trickles in off his blocker. I mean, sometimes it just doesn't go your way, and it's really hard to stop that snowball once it picks up steam. And just one of those nights, it just sucks that it was his first game, and it sucks that he was thrown into that situation, and the team laid an absolute egg in front of him. I mean, You're right. The first shot that he faced goes in. Three of the first five go in. The breakdowns that occurred in front of him before that first one, I'm like, Branson behind the net, just a gong show back there. Never mind the fact that he's chasing back there in the first place. Zach McEwen playing his first game makes a couple of mistakes on his first shift. You know, and even to a coach who throws that line combination out there, knowing he's got a 19-year-old goaltender, that defensive pair out there, knowing he's got a 19-year-old goaltender making his debut against one of the top offenses in the league. I mean, just a series of unfortunate events for Michael DiPietro on Monday night. And yet, so yeah, mentally, it's a test. Not one that he isn't equipped to handle. Loved everything he said after the game. Loved the way he approached the whole situation. And I don't think this is, you know, anybody worried about scarring Michael DiPietro probably doesn't know much about the character and the background and the backstory that got him to this point. So, hey, organization was caught with his pants down in terms of its goaltending depth and not doing something about it. You know, almost as soon as they lost Mike McKenna off waivers after acquiring him from Ottawa for Anders Nilsson in order to get Thatcher Demko up. Didn't see the urgency in adding a third goaltender. Waited once Demko got hurt. Obviously, now you start calling around and teams are going to want more because they know you're in trouble. And so they didn't solve that problem and it bit them. And, you know, magically, or maybe they just didn't care to solve the problem or care enough to solve the problem. And magically, a day after the DiPietro debacle, they've got Marek Mazanets from the New York Rangers for a seventh-round pick in 2020. So, to me, that's a problem you could have solved earlier and not had to put the kid through it. But I don't think it's going to scar him long-term at all. It's just, that's just his character is too strong for that.
Kevin Woodley of In Goal Magazine and NHL.com is our guest on NHL this week. We're talking about goaltenders. And, Kevin, any conversation about goaltenders as of late in the NHL has to include Carter Hart, who's been on an absolute tear since getting called up by the Flyers, who have had such woeful goaltending, I could say this year, but I could probably say for the last decade or so. You know, what makes Carter Hart so special as a goaltender? And do you think that there's a way that instead of the Flyers being in the goaltender market, maybe Carter Hart has done enough to consider the possibility that he might be in a timeshare next season as opposed to getting another full season of full season at the AHL level?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, you talk to Carter Hart and he'll tell you he's ready to be in. Then I'm like, forget a timeshare. Who do you want to bring in to back me up? And he's not saying that. Those aren't his words to me directly. But I can tell you, like, you know, late last season in the Western Hockey League, he felt like he was ready for the NHL. That's the way this kid's wired. It's the way he's trained. He's trained for this his whole life. You know, a lot of people worried again. You know, again, they talked about mentally. Like, oh, like, what happens if this kid gets thrown to the wolves and the team is terrible as they tend to be? You're going to ruin him. If you know Carter Hart, if you know the work he's put in with John Stevenson, who's probably most famous as being the sports psychologist or mental performance coach of Braden Holtby, I mean, Carter's been working with him since he was 12 or 13 years old. He has a confidence. He has a belief in the foundation of his game. You see people on TV when they describe him playing, go to cliches like calm, quiet, in terms of his style. And it is. But there's a technical foundation to the way he plays, a top-down sort of trigger in his movements that allows him to build angle before he pushes and build sort of all his coverage before he makes a lateral push rather than just pushing frantically and then worrying about being set and being square and being on angle once he gets there. And that's where that calmness comes from. And he's got a deep-seated belief, a deep-rooted belief in how he plays. That's going to serve him like that's the foundation, and it will provide a level of consistency. There are layers above that. Some you know are just pure reaction and athleticism. Some will come with experience in terms of advanced reads, as you know, as he kind of gets to know players and tendencies and things like that at the NHL level. But as far as the concept of him going back to the AHL, like. I don't see that happening at all. And maybe I'm wrong. I mean, goaltending's unpredictable, and maybe he stumbles. But I really believe that he's probably here to stay. And frankly, at this point, if you send him to the American Hockey League, unless the wheels really came off and all those things I talked about tell me that they won't, all you'd be doing is training him to be an American Hockey League goaltender at that point. The way he plays, the way he moves, the efficiency in his game, if you're not worried about the mental strength, and like I said, I don't think you need to, then I actually think the NHL is probably easier for him because there's more control. There's less scrambles than there are in the American Hockey League. Guys are where they're supposed to be and tend to do what they are supposed to do more often than they do in the American Hockey League. And I think he's just better suited for the NHL right now. And so, no, I don't see this as a young guy just on a hot streak. I see this as a young guy who's prepared to play this way at this level for a long time. And in his mind, he's just going on doing what he's capable of. So I don't expect – there'll be blips, sure. But I think sending him back down, short of his confidence getting shattered, and again, I just can't see it happening. I think he's here to stay.
Kevin, we haven't spoken to you in a little while, so I know it's a bit old news, but I wanted to pick your brain on what your reaction was to hearing about the Mikko Koskinen deal with the Oilers. How did you see that trade, or pardon me, that signing?
They like him. They like a lot about his game, and you know, I know he had a pretty good night tonight. I didn't see the whole thing, but I caught long chunks of it. After Cam Talbot getting a good run, which gave Mikko some time with his goaltending coach in Edmonton to kind of clean up some of the details that had slipped. He's come a long way this year. I know his season's kind of gone the other way in terms of numbers were better early, and then they slipped, ironically, right before the contract. But they love the way he works. They see upside in that. There are elements of his game that have had to change since arriving in Russia, and his ability to do so in short order impresses him. The work he puts in before and after practice, the desire to get better, the understanding of the game. Like, there's a lot of elements that they like about him. Now, was the contract rich? Yeah, I've yet to see anybody who thinks it's a good deal. Was Edmonton going to overpay for goaltending no matter what? Probably. I mean, in a year where we could have an unprecedented run of big-name free agents, I think of Bobrovsky, and I would have normally said Varlamov before, as you pointed out earlier, he's kind of hit the skids. The reality is goaltenders, and I talk to them all the time about this, like they don't want to play in Edmonton. They see what a train wreck that team is defensively, and they want no part of it. They see Devan Dubnyk leave Edmonton and have success. They see Laurent Brossoit struggle in Edmonton and go to Winnipeg and have the success that he's having. Like, goaltenders aren't stupid. When I talk about the wheels coming off in Colorado and thinking maybe it has something to do with what's going on in front of them, like, goaltending never exists in a vacuum. There's only so much a goaltender can do outside of defensive structure. And the defensive structure, even with Hitchcock, it's improved. Talking to the goalies there, the plays have become somewhat more predictable, but all relative to, you know, arguably the worst sort of structure in the NHL for several years. So they were going to overpay for goaltending in free agency. They decided to overpay for a guy that they sort of, the devil you know, if you pardon the expression. But at least they know what they have in him, and they think there's something there that they can work with. And I guess that's better than overpaying for something you're less certain about. So hard to defend the numbers, but at least trying to sort of grain of salt why it might have happened that way. Doesn't excuse that it was as big as it was, especially given some of the other contracts we've seen, you know, sort of guys sign around the league, a little younger, a little less experienced, like DeSmith, you know, more pure backups like Copley, but the comparables don't flatter the contract. But what are you going to do? I guess they were overpaying no matter what. Might as well overpay for a guy they like.
Last question for you, Kevin. Kevin Woodley of In Goal Magazine and NHL.com is our guest on NHL This Week. Jordan Binnington, 10-1-1 since he's been called up to be the number one guy for the St. Louis Blues. He's been a career minor leaguer up to this point. Is there any reason to believe that this isn't just a goaltender on a heater? Is there any reason to think that he's a late bloomer who's maybe just coming into his own as maybe an NHL goaltender?
Yeah, you know, I talked to some of the goaltending coaches, you know, early in this run for him. Because it was preceded by a really good run in the American Hockey League. Mm-hmm. So I talked to a couple of the guys that he's worked with in this summer. They're actually with other organizations during the year, but guys he works with in the summer and some of the coaches he's been involved with. And they predicted like 2-3 games into this that this was him arriving to stay, that this wasn't just a blip or, as you said, a heater. There's been a shift in terms of his work ethic, mentality. You know, so often we hear guys, oh, he's a good pro. Well, some of these guys take a while to learn how to be a good pro. And Binnington really kind of dug in over the past two summers into the things he needed to do to reach another level. The other thing I think sometimes when we talk about late bloomers, like, you know, Jacob Markstrom in Vancouver, statistically it's not a crazy season, but he's been really good here. And he's been better than I thought he was capable of, frankly. And that's under a new goaltending coach. And sometimes, whether it's with a team making a change with a goaltending coach, or in Binnington's case, maybe a combination of that and the work he does in the summer privately, sometimes you get, there's something new that comes into your life as a goaltender that clicks in a way that nothing else has before. And everybody sort of finds that at a different stage. Sometimes it'll be a mental thing. Sometimes it'll be a technical tip. He's always sort of had a good foundation in terms of skill and ability. He's applied that better. And something's clicked. And so the people that I trust to know the game and know the goalie better than me really believe that this was the start of something. And, you know, now 8, 9, 10 games later, with him basically carrying the Blues back into the playoffs or playoff race and probably look good for a spot right now in the Turtle Derby that is the Western Conference, you know, it looks like they're right. The other part of this, too, and this applies to Hart, this applies to a lot of guys, Kevin Boyle. I had to hit pause when you guys called, but we're headed into the third period in Anaheim, and he's pitching a shutout in his NHL debut, about the same age, 25.
Do you want the spoiler?
Colin D. What's that?
Do you want us to spoil that, or should we just let you catch up on the PVR?
Don't spoil it. I paused it for you.
Okay.
I got little to look forward to.
Okay.
Don't spoil it for me.
Okay, I'll be quiet.
It's miserable. Give me this.
I'll give you that. I'll be quiet.
No, but, like, he's been really good tonight. And Delia, I mentioned. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing here is, you know, at a time when the youth movement in the NHL has never included goaltenders, and I don't think we're going to get, like, Carter Hart's still going to be an exception. We're not going to see 18, 19-year-old goaltenders like we do 18, 19, 20-year-old skilled forwards, high-end draft picks. But I do find it interesting that we're seeing more of these sort of 23, 22 guys that we, you know, guys like Binnington, guys like Delia that weren't maybe high-profile, Boyle tonight. Like, these guys are having success. And I do think in some ways it's because this new NHL, this more open, this more dynamic lateral attacks that we're seeing teams embrace, higher quality scoring chances, save percentage dropping by 5 points in 1 year. I think in some ways this style is what these kids have grown up with. I've talked to a couple of them about it. Thatcher Demko, who's only played one game up here this year, but it was a good one, and he kind of talked about it. Like he didn't grow up playing behind a 1-4 neutral zone trap. It was odd man rushes and breakaways. There is a different style of attack. There's a more dynamic offensive players. There are less stay-at-home defensemen. The game is changing for goalies. Their reads are changing. Expectations are changing in terms of what is a good night, what is a good save percentage. And a lot of the older guys are talking about having to adjust to it. These young kids, this is the game they know. And so it'll be interesting to see, again, no idea what happens to Boyle after I hit pause. He maybe just gave up 5 while we were talking. But as you see these guys have success, guys that wouldn't have gotten an opportunity short of injuries to other guys like Crawford in Chicago giving Delia the opportunity, maybe more teams start to, you know, rather than locking in long-term on a big-name free agent, maybe they start to see what they've got in the minors. Maybe they start to see whether that 23-year-old that they thought, you know, needs more time actually is ready, because the game may suit their style and their expectations and their experiences a lot more than it does that 32-year-old who's having to adjust to all these changes.
Kevin Woodley covers the world of goaltending for NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. Kevin, we always appreciate your insight. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll let you get back to the Canucks and the Ducks game.
My pleasure. Thanks for not spoiling it for me, guys.
Take care, Kevin. Thanks again. When we come back, one final segment. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
One final segment Wednesday evening here on NHL This Week. Speaking of Saturday, the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show, 9 a.m. Saturday. We'll get you set for the rematch between the Jets and the Senators. The Jets look for revenge after dropping that game last Saturday afternoon to the worst team in the NHL. So that'll be Saturday night, a game you can of course hear live on TSN Radio 1290. And that's one game ahead of tomorrow night, where the Jets and the Avalanche will do battle in a Central Division tilt. A quick look at the out of town scoreboard in Pittsburgh tonight. Stop me if you've heard this before. The Edmonton Oilers lost. Penguins 3, Oilers 1. A big win for the Penguins, who are holding on to a wild card spot in the Eastern Conference. The Oilers, it still continues to be the only team that Connor McDavid has not beaten. He's 0-3-3 against the Pittsburgh Penguins. Oilers losing. They're still battling for the playoffs. And with late in the third period, the Anaheim Ducks continue to have a 1-0 lead over the Vancouver Canucks. It's the Ducks are holding on for dear life as the Canucks look to equalize late in the third period. That's it for the Wednesday edition of NHL This Week. A big thank you to our guests, Kevin Woodley, Dennis Bernstein, and AJ Hayfley. In case you missed any of the show, it's available for download on our website, illegalcurve.com. It's on tsn1290.ca. It's wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, get it sent to your device each and every week. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group, Realty. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. Big props to producer Chris Curry, doing a great job behind the board. For my colleague Sean Asor, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday at 9 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck. And thanks for listening to NHL This Week on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio 1290.